Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, March 25, 2016. Riek Machar's bodyguards are expected to be in Juba next week ahead of the arrival of South Sudan's first vice president-designate in the capital.
From Monday, with the help of the British and the Norwegians, we will be transporting Riek's personal bodyguards and others from the northern city of Malakal to here in Juba.
And the U.S. government offers scholarships for teachers in South Sudan.
The education that we are aspiring for now is the 21st century education, because our children must be at the same level that the world is. Without good teachers, you can never have a good education.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, JMAC, says the South Sudan government and the SPLM in opposition are making steady progress in implementing the AGAS peace deal. Festus Mohai says the British and Norwegian governments have agreed to pay the cost of transport for Riek Machar's bodyguards from Malakal to Juba next week. He says China will also provide food and clean water to government and SPLA-IO troops who will be stationed 25 kilometers outside Juba. Mohai says the South Sudanese people should expect the formation of the transitional government of national unity very soon.
We have missed a great many deadlines. However, we are making some progress, although slowly. We are not happy. But right now, I expect a number of things to take place. The first 22 of the opposition's policemen returned yesterday. From Monday, with the help of the British and the Norwegians, we will be transporting Riek's personal bodyguards and others from the northern city of Malakal to here in Juba. We have obtained Chinese assistance to prepare the site, to sink more holes, provide water, and also give a donation of 170,000 tons of rice for both the returning men of the opposition and of the government, so that the transitional government of national unity can be formed. I will be reporting to the Security Council by Friday, hopefully, and I expect these developments to have taken place. But of course, violations are still occurring.
Given the track record of these two parties reneging on most of their promises, is there any cause to believe that indeed they are going to form a government of national unity?
They could have done so much, much earlier. They have delayed, but as I say, we have been making progress. After all this, we were able to bring back the former detainees, and then we brought back the advanced parties of the opposition. Now, and therefore, that's why JMAC has been able to start and have been engaging both sides together with the international community. So that was progress, even though it's late, but it's the final step of the final return of the prospective first vice president with his personal security, and therefore the formation of the transitional government of national unity.
Who is delaying the formation of the transitional government of national unity?
Both are guilty because both have been violating the terms of the agreement. And each time one side violates a particular aspect, it gives the other side an excuse to protest and delay and do all sorts of things. So both of them are to blame. Tell the South Sudanese that both of them are to blame, and those of them are to blame for fighting. Both of them are to blame for some of the things that are happening in the country right now, which are not good.
What kind of support are you getting from the international community to use so that you can, if you like, discipline the two parties to keep to the promises that they made to the South Sudanese people in August?
The international community is pressurizing everybody to stop the fighting, to form a transitional government of national unity which can speak with one voice to seek development assistance from the international community. But even now, the international community is helping. For instance, there are people in protection of civilian centers in Bentu, in the center of the country, in Malakal, in the north, in Bor, another part of the country, and even here in Juba. These are people who are in what are called protection of civilian centers. They have taken refuge in places which are now protected by the United Nations and the World Food Program and the Red Cross and Oxfam and others are delivering food supplies to them all over the country. But they are being hindered by armed people, some of them in government uniforms, some of them in opposition uniforms, and others just in other types of uniforms. And so it's a very undesirable situation.
That's former Botswana President Festus Mohai, chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the body tasked with monitoring South Sudan's peace agreement. He was speaking with me from Juba earlier today during an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus. Some analysts are advising the government of South Sudan to borrow money from external sources to address the country's heavy reliance on imported food. Mungume Davis Rakarinj has more for VOA from Juba.
Ahmed Morgan, professor of economics at the University of Juba, says with dwindling oil revenues, the country is not able to engage in developmental projects.
I think the country needs support in terms of donation. It may need, if it has external borrowings that can support the economy, especially from the IMF or the World Bank, they should come in to at least rescue the country.
Morgan says he believes such international institutions will only lend South Sudan money once the country's leaders form the transitional government of national unity, which is long overdue. Morgan says that will boost the international community's confidence in the government. James Alish Garang, a policy analyst at the Juba-based think tank, the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says in order to have the desired impact on the economy, the government must ensure that it uses all the money from loans to boost production.
The kind of borrowing that we are seeing today is only meant for consumption. It's only meant to pay salaries for people to consume. That's not production. But the kind of borrowing I'm talking about is that the government would borrow money and put that money in the reserve for the government or for the bank to use that to stabilize the macroeconomic environment.
South Sudan relies on oil exports for more than 90% of government revenues. According to a 2015 report by the global research and consulting firm Global Data, oil production in South Sudan has fallen significantly since 2013 due to lower demand. Global Data says prior to the conflict, South Sudan was producing around 250,000 barrels per day. The sharp decline in global oil prices is another reason for the drop in oil revenue. Oil prices fell from nearly $200 per barrel to less than $40 per barrel over the past year. Aside from the loss in oil revenues, the government was pumping much of its hard currency reserves into weapons and other big purchases connected to fighting the armed rebellion over the past 2 years. Alich says in the long run, the government must invest in agriculture to cut expenditures on food imports.
Today they are even importing onion and simple things that can be produced here. So if there's a way for the government to invest in agriculture, to produce locally, for people to consume them locally, then that is a productive investment.
South Sudan imports nearly all consumer products from Uganda, Kenya and other neighboring countries. Morgan says this must stop. He says now that South Sudan has been admitted into the East African community, the government must tap into the advantages of being part of a regional bloc.
We expect capital to move from the other East African countries towards South Sudan because of the cheaper land that will be available. And that one also will depend on the country revising its land law policies, which would allow investment in agriculture. Secondly, we also expect labor movement to move from where labor is surplus to, you know, where labor is needed. And this will boost investment in the agricultural area.
Above all, Garang and Morgan say any efforts aimed at ending the economic crisis will only succeed when the two warring parties fully implement the peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Still in Juba, 20 South Sudanese students will benefit from education scholarships awarded by the United States Agency for International Development starting next month. Officials say $2.5 million project will help train education administrators, teachers, and students in South Sudan. Philip Thorne Aleu reports for VOA from Juba.
Mary Medrea is one of a dozen women selected to be part of the Master's in Education project run by the University of Juba. Madria says, with this opportunity, her childhood dream has finally come true.
When I was still young, my plan is to become a teacher, but unfortunately, I did not. But it's a much pleasure for me to get the master's degree so that I will be able to help my people here in South Sudan. Let me say, the level of education is low, so it's like when I develop myself, I will be able to develop my country.
Other scholarship beneficiaries say they too plan to help develop their country after receiving Master's in Education. The Master's in Education project is an upshot from the USAID funded South Sudan Higher Education Initiative for Equity and Leadership Development. In that program, 14 South Sudanese women attended Indiana University in the United States in 2013. Nine of them are now lecturers at universities in South Sudan. U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan, Molly Fee, says women who are the main target of this program will play a vital role in post-conflict South Sudan.
One of the things that you have to learn to adjust to is you have to learn how to educate in emergencies better. You have to be able to find ways to make sure that children have access to education despite what the context is.
Peace says the United States will ensure that South Sudanese leaders fully implement the peace agreement so that children are able to return to schools. She says millions of South Sudanese children have not had access to education over the last 2 years of conflict. South Sudan Education Minister John Guy says the Master's in Education program provides a rare opportunity for education leaders.
And so education that we are aspiring for now is a 21st century education, not just an education, because our children must be at the same level that the world is. Without good teachers, you can never have a good education. Forget it. Anything that we are doing here in South Sudan, if we don't fix our teachers' education, it's not going to work.
Guy says his ministry will open 3 of the 5 national teacher training centers this year. But he says it will be difficult to open all of them due to lack of funds. Professors from Indiana University will be visiting the University of Juba to give lectures over the next 2 years. University of Juba officials say this exchange program might develop into a long-term partnership between the two universities so that South Sudanese and Americans can interact more frequently. For VOA News, I am Philip Onaleu in Juba.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you consider yourself traditional or modern?
Modern. I'm not traditional. I'm really modern. Updated with the technology, the way I dress, it's all modern. Staying in the city, urban ways of life, that is it.
Traditional, because as the Swahili says goes, mwacha mila ni mtumwa. It's good that you go by your cultures rather than going to the modern one because you don't know its disadvantages. So it is better to go with the one that you know the advantages and the disadvantages.
Some traditional things that are dear to me and the modern things that I hold on to.
I embrace traditional aspects. I'm also embrace modernity. So it's a mixture of both.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Talks between Sudan and rebel groups have ended with no hope in sight for a peaceful resolution of the ongoing conflict in the country. The 3-day of negotiations ended Monday evening. The government signed a roadmap agreement as presented by the mediating panel, but rebels' representative refused to sign and left in protest. Nabil Biagio has this report for VOA from Khartoum.
The roadmap drafted by the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel calls for a commitment to reach a cessation of hostilities agreement that would lead to a permanent ceasefire in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile states. It also laid out plans to form committees that would resolve political matters regarding security arrangements. Presidential aide and chief negotiator for Blue Nile and South Kordofan, Ibrahim Mahmoud Hamid, signed the roadmap agreement on behalf of the government. But all three rebel groups refused to sign, as did the head of the opposition National Ummah Party, Sadiq al-Mahdi. Sudanese political commentator Faisal Saleh says the document presented by Thabo Mbeki would not have resolved any of the conflicts in the three areas.
The roadmap has complicated the situation. First of all, it was drafted by one side, by Mbeki himself and his panel, and he has given the parties zero choice, either to accept it as a package or refuse it. And what happened is that the government have accepted and signed, and the four group of the opposition who participated in the meeting in Addis Ababa refused to sign it.
Saleh says the opposition did not sign the roadmap because they believe it is a sham and will only drag them into Mr. Bashir's national dialogue.
The main point that made the group of the four opposition party not to sign was the acknowledgement of the current process of the national dialogue as the only venue or of a forum to discuss the national issues. It came as a surprise because Mbeki panel was not part of the national dialogue process. Even they didn't attend the opening session, which could be a sign of acknowledgement. They never monitored the process. They were not part of the monitors.
Saleh says now it appears there is nothing more Mbeki can do.
After the end of the week, if the opposition refused to sign, the only thing he has left to him is to submit his report to the UN Security Council, and that could be the end of his mission. That's what I expect. And I think practically his mission has come to end.
Khartoum-based political analyst Haj Hamad says the roadmap agreement was based on the fact that Khartoum is now in a strong military position after the total defeat of Abdul Wahid's rebel group in Jabal Marra.
The government at this moment in the history of dialogue is having a more positive cards in its hands than the opposition group, whether it is armed or civilian.
Hamad says in the past, when the rebels had a stronger presence on the ground, they were able to press the government for more concessions.
Last time, when Mbeki was accused by the government that he was leaning towards the rebel groups and the opposition, simply they were more organized, having a lot of elements in the ground, and for this reason, he was trying to push the government as a weak side to the strengths of the strong.
Hamad says the rebels and Sadiq al-Mahdi's opposition group are refusing to join President Bashir's national dialogue because the process is completely under the control of the government, so the opposition do not believe any real change can come out of it.
If you can see now, the pendulum is moving towards the side of the government. So I'm not saying the opposition is wrong by denying to sign a paper that will put them into a national dialogue to which the results is not yet certain. Those who are already indulged with the government in this dialogue are already shouting a lot of foul names against the behavior and the way the government is conducting and managing the dialogue in its own favor.
The Sudanese rebels and opposition groups issued a joint statement calling on all Sudanese to stage an uprising to topple the government. They also promised to explain how they intend to engage with the government in the future. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
Officials in Uganda and South Sudan have adopted several resolutions that promote peaceful coexistence between two communities that have been fighting each other on the South Sudan-Uganda border. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Relations between the people of Kajokeji and Moyo began to deteriorate in September 2014 over a disputed piece of land. That conflict led to violent clashes on both sides of the border, pitting members of the two communities against each other. Several people were killed and property was destroyed. To many relations, leaders of both communities recently held two meetings, one in Kajokeji last weekend and one in Moyo on Wednesday. Julius Lokonga is Kajokeji County Commissioner.
One of the resolutions is that both communities or both sides should cease hostilities against one another and foster dialogue to resolve disputes or misunderstanding, and encourage elders and elders of the two communities to desist from telling negative stories that are very detrimental to the next generation. The other one is that both sides request that media houses and churches to preach forgiveness, love and reconciliation, and peaceful coexistence between the two communities.
Didi Paul, vice chairperson of Moyo District's Local Council 5, says authorities in Moyo also think the resolutions could restore good relations between the communities.
These are the things if the Republic of South Sudan and the Republic of Uganda can do, it will back up the community resolution for a lasting peaceful coexistence.
Paul says the two communities also call for the governments of South Sudan and Uganda to speed up on the demarcation of the border between the two countries. Residents in Kajokeji say they think the initiative of holding meetings between the two communities and the resolutions passed will help cement better relations between the two communities. Ramson Doko is a resident of Kajokeji town. He thinks the resolutions passed are good ones.
It's a way to go forward, only that if we can be able to, you know, both communities can be able to put in action what we have been resolved. It shouldn't be anything that remains pen on paper. And in the long term, if we engage both communities to continue in doing this dialogue, not just a one-time moment, but should be rather prolonged moment of negotiation and sitting together, trying to talk all that happened.
Kajokeji resident Alfred George Jame agrees.
The resolutions are good, and I'm quite sure in the near future things will be okay.
But the dispute over the patch of land that started the conflict has yet to be resolved. Government officials, traditional chiefs, women, youth, business owners, and religious leaders all attended the recent meetings, which were sponsored by a British-based non-profit called the Concordis International. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Sudanese refugees living in Uganda say it's becoming more difficult to practice some of their cultural traditions, such as paying bride price, which is typically paid in cattle. Some refugees say even though their culture only recognizes cattle as a form of dowry, they have come around to accept money for bride payment. Bonifacio Taban traveled to Boale refugee settlement in camp in Uganda and has this report from Kampala.
Ron Machatural, a South Sudanese living in Uganda via a refugee settlement camp, says many lost boys have returned from America to marry girls from this camp. He said just last month his brother's daughter, who lives in the camp, married to a man who came all the way from the United States. He said the family want her dowry to be paid in the form of cattle, but they accept money in exchange for cattle because they are in a foreign country.
According to the agreement, because there is some people who is not here, some people are far in Khartoum, we agree some cow fee transfer to money. You just calculate how is a girl to marry for how many cow.
Tural said although the newer culture does not recognize money as a dowry, people living in refugees camp have come to realize they should accept money as a dowry. In some cases, he said, foreign will accept that part of the dowry be paid in money, while the rest will be paid in cattle in near future, once the refugees return to South Sudan. Tural said, although some communities still enforce the payment of cash for dowry, he believes it does not contradict the traditional norm. In your custom, marriage is a communal practice. When a girl is married, all the relatives expect to get a share of the cattle paid for bride wealth. Troll said, even when the dowry is paid in money, relatives can still get their shares. In some South Sudanese society, parents choose husband for their daughters. Troll called that an outdated practice, saying girl must be given the right to choose their partners. Troll said, last year two girls at the camp got married to lost boy. He said the practice of paying cows for dowry will soon disappear as people adapt to a monetary economy.
Even now when my girl married, there is someone in a village, he need cow. Even I'm in town with my girl. In town, I gain money, but this one who is still there because he has a right to give. I give him something because according to our culture, he's still there. But 15 years to come or 10 years to come, maybe the cow to change, people maybe use money.
Members of the Nuer community in the camp have set up a customary court to resolve criminal case and marry dispute. Galodul hate the traditional court in Biala refugee settlement. Speaking in Nuer, Dol said some young men in the camp impregnate girls out of wedlock instead of following the proper procedure to marry them. He said that kind of behaviors often bring conflict within the community. He said his customary court is expected to punish and arrest youths who violate traditional marriage practice.
For example, I am a man who is a
Galo said, as the leader of the court, he and others will settle disputes on issues related to marriage and criminal activities. If the girl is impregnated, Galo said, we charge the person is responsible to pay 5 cows to the parent of the girl, and this is in the form of money. He said, if the boy loves the girl, they settle the case by bringing both parents to reach an agreement based on local marriage procedure. He said they only step in when there are real disputes. Dol said despite living in a foreign country, South Sudanese community, including the Nuer, still want to practice the Amari custom as provided for in the community customary law. Galo said, our being here is to enact law and order for everyone who may be in this camp. He said, they cannot live like animals. They need to live responsibly. We have to tell them when they are wrong and when they are doing the right thing, Galo said. For VOA News, I'm Bonifacio Taban in Kampala.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song, A Wife is a Blessing from God by Saka Number One.
MC Malumalu. Fi haja benu sahili lakini mahaja sahili ya kwanie. Bi aino haja sakit lakini mahaja sakit ya kwani. Fi haja benu sahili lakini mahaja sahili ya kwani. Bi aino haja sahili lakini mahaja sahili ya kwanie. Mane hadi ya min ala. Ooh. Wife is a blessing from God Almighty. Ooh. Kanita mendu mara binadita lo bilong. Kanita jibu mara bijibu leta ilong. That's why I say blessing, blessing. Mara de hadi ya min rabuna. Blessing. A wife is a blessing from God Almighty. Blessing, blessing. Marade hadi amin Allah. Blessing.
We've been listening to Isaka Number One with the song A Wife is a Blessing. Remember, these are not my words. I'm John Tanza in Washington. On behalf of my colleagues at the South Sudan in Focus, we wish you a happy Easter. Have a wonderful holiday weekend. We hope you meet us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.